Hello and welcome to Cruising Through History. My name is Xander. I am sitting down with Scott Cruz. Scott, where are we cruising through today?
Well, Xander, I thought I'd talk about code breaking during World War II.
Okay, so let's start at the very beginning. What is code breaking?
Well, code breaking is when it's actually called cryptanalysis or cryptology. I just call it.
So not related to like coding, but.
No, it's when you're trying to decipher a belligerent, in this case, the Germans or the Japanese, their messages, because all of those were sent in code.
I see.
So it's a constant race to break a code before they figure out you've broken the code, and then they change it, then you break it again, and then it's sort of an on and on, ongoing process.
So it's more like cryptography, or I think there's an official term for that, than like some form of computer code.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And in fact, it wasn't until later that I guess we'd say the precursors of computers were used to start breaking these. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about Alan Turing in a little bit, but he was involved in that. The Germans had a thing called the Enigma machine, and it's kind of known but Enigma was just a brand name. It wasn't like named for any purpose, because it was invented right after World War I, and it was actually marketed for commercial uses, like businesses encrypting things, and it was fairly easy to break until the military got involved. Then they made it much more difficult.
So it's not just this random thing that sounds menacing. It's a company's brand name product.
Yes, right. And in fact, it was after World War I, a lot of inventors sort of thought they came up with this thing called a polyalphabetic substitution. There'll be some technical stuff in here, and I'll try not to go too heavy on it because even I got a little confused sometimes talking about it. But what all that means is, so you use one row of letters, let's say you got the alphabet, and then you use other rows of alphabets that are scrambled. And these machines, these Enigma machines, had three rotors, and what the rotors would do is it would randomly type out a message in plain text, or you take a message in what's called plain text, which is just your message. Mm-hmm. You run it through this, and that's called a ciphertext, so that the coded message goes out.
And so other people will know the like four lines of code and how to translate it, like people you want to know it. But
yes, they'll have like a key on the other end that they can use to read the message.
And so that is more secure than, you know, just sending a message. If that's intercepted, no one else can.
And the reason it really ramped up during World War, because in World War I, there had been some of this. There was a place called Room 40 at the British Admiralty that specialized in breaking codes. Mm-hmm. But it was really in World War II because the use of radio communications and Morse code radio communications really increased. So a lot of this was intercepting these radio messages. And then, I mean, you also had the problem of first you had to break the code, then translate it. Mm-hmm. I mean, these weren't in English. It was a worse problem for the Americans because they were trying to decode these messages and then translate them from Japanese.
Yeah, and Japanese, if you're translating German uses a similar alphabet to English.
Yes.
Where Japanese is symbols and not like basically Anglo-ized.
And some of our listeners may know what this term is, but so the intelligence they got from Enigma was called Ultra. It sometimes gets confusing because there's a name for the machine and then there's the name for the intelligence they get from it. So in the case of the Americans, they had a machine, they had actually cracked the Japanese diplomatic code, which was called Purple, and the JN-25, which was the naval code, and that intelligence was called Magic. And I hope I got that right and didn't.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of names for these things that are just like,
right.
Well, we got the magic, so we know all the messages from.
And in fact, it's really weird because in 1927, the British actually bought an Enigma machine. Mm-hmm. And later on in the 30s and early in the war, the Germans had given Enigma machines to the nationalist side in the Spanish Civil War and to the Italian Navy, but it wasn't the one the military used. So the British cracked those. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't really the British to start with. And I think this gets lost in the story, and I have kind of want to mention it. There was a guy named Marian Radziewski, who's Polish. And it really was the Poles in the 1930s that first cracked the Enigma code. And they worked on it through the 30s. And it wasn't until 1939 that they shared what they knew with the British and the French. But they were already working with the French because it was, this guy came up with this. It was some kind of mathematical group theory that he used to break the code. But he was also, the French were also being aided by a German spy named Hans Schmidt, who was working in the German cipher office, and he was handing things to the French. And so that's how they sort of figured out the original breaking of the Enigma code. Now, the military used was different. They used what was called a plug board, which made it even more complex. But it was trying to break those rotors, because the whole thing is not to discover a pattern. I mean, we talked about this, and I'll give a little background on how I came up with this idea of this topic. I was talking to a colleague about the Rosetta Stone and how they translated that.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they didn't know that ancient Egyptian language, they noticed similarities and they just started. And that's kind of what code breaking is. You find a pattern and you just start using it. So if you have a number for a letter, let's say, you can figure out if the letter or the number shows up a lot of times, it's probably a vowel.
Yeah.
Or something of that nature.
And like, language is meant to be predictable. I mean, that's the point. I mean, we know English can be weird as a language, but every language is weird.
Yes.
So cracking these is very, very similar to cracking a language if you can find patterns. But if the machine is designed to not have patterns or
right.
something like that, like it changes it up, then it becomes even harder to
right. And
crack.
The Poles, in 1939, the Germans had pulled out of a German-Polish non-aggression pact they had signed in 1934. So the Polish military and people in their code breaking and intelligence said, I think we know what's coming next, an invasion of the country, which did come in September. So that's when they started handing over stuff to the British and the French, because they knew that the Germans didn't pull out of this for no reason, that they were probably about to go down, and they kind of did what
yeah.
they did. And so in the meantime, the Poles set up this. They got some of the cryptographers out of Poland. They set up a thing called PC Bruno, which was a signals intelligence office in Paris. Well, of course, that only lasted to June of 1940. But in the meantime, the British set up the government code and cipher school in Bletchley Park, which, of course, everyone kind of knows because of Alan Turing and the movie. And that's what was going on there. They were trying to break these codes. But it was hard work, and actually a lot of them had nervous breakdowns because they'd work like 20 hours a day, and they knew if they didn't break these, you know, human lives were in the balance.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, there were intelligence failures. I mean, because I can give you all this information, Xander, but it doesn't mean you'll act on it,
mm-hmm.
or it doesn't even mean you'll look at it, because sometimes it was overwhelming the amount that they had and what was real and what may have been deception.
Yeah, because, I mean, wasn't that something we've talked about this before? It was another World War II operation we've talked about before, Mincemeat, where war is not just sending stuff out for your allies, but sending stuff out to trick your enemies.
Exactly, and that's what Mincemeat was. It was a deception operation where they put the corpse in the water with all these official-looking forms, and of course for the invasion of Sicily, and it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people within these Allied governments were concerned about that. A lot of them didn't even think there was any value to this, because they thought, how do you know this isn't all just... Of course, after a few successes, they figured out that, no, they were probably reading the right messages.
Yeah.
So what the Poles came up with was a thing called a cryptological bomb. Now, I don't know why they call it a bomb. It's like a big computer. Well, I think it comes from the Polish word bomba, B-O-M-B-A.
Okay.
Now, in English, it's spelled B-O-M-B-E, but you don't say the E. In fact, I looked this up like a million times trying to make sure I pronounced it correctly, because I kept calling it a bombi because I was attributing it to the similarity with the Polish word.
I see.
But I kept thinking, can you imagine? This might have caused a little confusion when if you walked into a place and said, I have a bomb. You know, you didn't have a bomb. You had a computer. But what those did is it started to help, as Turing developed his, it really started, because what it would do, it would try to figure out what the Enigma machine's settings were, where its rotors were, what the key was. And it was pretty difficult because, I mean, there were 17,576 possible scrambler positions for a set of wheel orders. And basically, I have this quote from a somebody who worked on this. It wasn't Turing, it was somebody else. But he said, the task of the bomb was simply to reduce the assumptions of wheel order and scrambler positions that required further analysis to a manageable number.
So it's like, imagine we're inputting all this information into this machine, and it's trying to reduce as much as possible the amount of things you have to consider.
Yes, it almost seems like it's sort of weeding out the stuff that probably doesn't really matter, and it's getting to the good stuff.
It's almost, and I mean, this is kind of like, for AI current day, it's almost similar to like large language models in a little bit, in that you're throwing a ton of information out and somehow then getting an output from that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so that's really all it was. And it was Turing who came up. Now, these weren't small machines. They could probably fit in this room. They were fairly large.
Like, we're talking things like, these machines probably aren't as powerful as our cell phones, and they're taking like the size of like the Uptown Library or something.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, but what's really interesting is that the Germans, they never really suspected anything was going on.
Really?
It's so odd. And you think now, like, you know, after a while, it seems fairly obvious something's going on because they seem to be everywhere. You know, they seem to be everywhere you are. So wouldn't you think? But what happened was they attributed it to the invention of radar, which the British did, and direction finding. So that's why they thought, oh, well, that's how they figured out where we were, you know, when we were at sea. Because a lot of this was the Navy. Ironically, too, the Enigma machine that the German Navy had was much more complex than what the Army had, or the Luftwaffe. Their machine had four rotors instead of three, so it made it even harder to decipher. And during the Battle of the Atlantic, so many ships were going to the bottom. That's why people, I think, were having nervous breakdowns, because they're thinking, you know, we can't decode this. We don't know what it is. It was the U.S. Navy built a machine that was faster. It used the same technology the British used, but somehow theirs was faster. And when they worked together, they helped to decipher the U-boat messages. And that's how the wolf packs, they started figuring out where the wolf packs were.
So some like extra con. So for one, the Germans were confident in their Enigma machine that they didn't even consider that as a possibility. The second is, this is all naval, and the ocean is big. Like, we don't understand, like, as humans, and we don't understand large numbers, the ocean is really big.
Yes.
So it would be more impactful even on sea than on land necessarily. So that's where this becomes even more important. Because on land, like, you can drive, you can, you know, see things further, but at sea...
And really, theoretically... A polyalphabetic substitution system is really set up to be unbreakable. But all it takes is for some nonchalant clerk somewhere not to change the setting and send the message out. And if you already, and if they don't change the setting, you basically, if you were doing other messages before, you basically have it. Because that's, and that would happen. In fact, they would even discipline people who were sending messages out if they didn't change the key. Because that happened a lot. And the Germans were, when they had keys on ships and that, they would print it in water-soluble ink, because then the ink would run and you couldn't read what the key was. Because you actually had, when they had salvage operations, people were looking for these machines and the keys to go with them. And they did get a couple. They did recover some, which helped in their decoding.
Yeah, and this communication, you mentioned that they had nervous breakdowns because lives are at stake. Because communication and then movement would be vastly important in war, even more so than battles themselves. Knowing where or when someone's going to be there means you can set up, you can be there first, all that stuff. So all of this massively important for the Allies in this case.
Right, and there's been intelligence in general during World War II. There's been some, because there's a difference between what's called COMINT, which is communication intelligence, and HUMINT, which is human intelligence spies. The spy thing gets more of the play because well, there's someone sitting in an office for 20 hours a day trying to crack a code. Mm-hmm. Or here's this gallant spy, you know, and we think of James Bond and everything.
Yeah.
And I think the reality was different. But it's also what you did with the intelligence, and we talked about that. The Americans had gotten intelligence that Rommel would attack in North Africa at the Kasserine Pass. They never did anything with it. So he did. And there were some, you know, and this doesn't have to do with code breaking, but Joseph Stalin believed right to the end that the Germans were not going to invade the Soviet Union, even though you had spies telling him and decrypted code saying, yeah, they are. And he would say, no, it's all allies that are planting that information. And of course it happened.
Yeah.
So it's all what you do with it, but also the volume, I think, can just overwhelm you. What do you do with all these messages? Some are bogus, probably.
Yeah, and these are not small operations for code breaking. This is like, you mentioned there's a school that was made for it. You're talking like hundreds of people, thousands of people potentially trying to work on these codes and messages, because there is that massive volume that's spreading countries of communication.
Right, yeah. And like I said, for the Americans, because there's always been, so everyone knew there was an intelligence failure at Pearl Harbor. But of course, some people think it was intentional to get the Americans into the war.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that so much as that they just didn't have enough personnel to translate everything they got.
Yeah.
There's a number, so in between September and December of 1941 alone, and this is not counting the purple intercepts they got from the diplomatic language codes, the U.S. intercepted 26,581 messages in naval or related systems. So this is just that system, the JN-25. It's not counting the purple. And actually, they did get a 14-part message that they translated from the purple code, and it was the message that the Japanese were to break off relations with the United States, and Franklin Roosevelt saw it on like December 6th and said, this means war. Now, the Japanese had talked about attacking places, but Pearl Harbor was one of them, but so were other places. The Philippines, which they did, the Dutch East Indies, which they also did, Borneo, which they did as well. So there were all these places, you just didn't know what would get hit first.
Yeah.
And yeah, sure, there was a failure. There was a failure there to defend that, you know, to have proper defenses in place too, and that all came out in congressional committees later. But unfortunately, I don't think it was, yeah, we're just going to pretend we don't have this, and there's plenty of things they could have done. Now, whether it was a conspiracy, I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, when you have so much conflicting information, I mean, what do you do with it? You only have so many resources.
Right.
That's really the big thing. I don't know if there's a lot of real-time strategy or civilization players for the video game listeners, right. But there's only so many things that an individual can act upon at the same time. And a lot of those games we talk about, like clicks per minute, like how much can you actually do per minute as everyone else is also doing all these different things. Now, if you have a fight on so many different fronts and then you get information that you might be adding four other war fronts to the mix, I mean, how do you move resources to address that, or do you at all? And it's only a risk. It hasn't happened yet versus, oh, there's this stuff here happening right now that we have to deal with. And that's where, I mean, this is where leaders have to make a decision, right? That's what they get elected for.
Right. And even at this time, I know it's hard for us to imagine now because, you know, we live in a state where it's easy to surveil people, to go through their electronic stuff and read their stuff. But even in the 30s and 40s, there was still, in America and in Britain, there was still sort of an aversion to doing that. You know, there was always in Britain, there was always the saying, a gentleman doesn't read another gentleman's mail. So a lot of guys wouldn't get involved in this because they thought it was beneath them or something.
I mean, that is still kind of a thing, at least with the public.
Yes.
Like, the public is still very much all in the private. When we talk about, like, NSA and we talking about Edward Snowden with that surveillance, people are enraged when that happens. But it's more governments nowadays, they're like, yeah, we want to get that information. There's no like, they're not hesitating. If they can get it, they'll get it.
Right.
But in this case, this is a new thing. Like, all this info, it wasn't a World War One thing, World War Two. Like, do we use
World
this?
World War Two? Yeah, World War Two. It really expanded.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Cold War. So they just took the methods they used. And there's all these great stories about Russian spies and, you know, going to a Dropbox in the middle of the night for documents.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think code breaking sometimes gets shunted to the side, because I guess people don't see it as romantic.
I mean, but there are some, like, heroes with code breaking, though. Like,
yes,
they
very
were super
so.
Important. So what, how, I guess, are there individuals, groups of people that were, that you've seen in here that are, like, big deals when it comes to code breaking?
Alan Turing's probably the biggest.
Okay, let's talk about him. What did he do?
He was a mathematician, I believe, but he really came up with the whole notion of, like, computer science. And he really, he's the one who had the ideas to improve these machines. And so that's where the computer science part comes in. And really, he was really inventing a whole new sort of cryptological thing, because the Poles, yes, they were the first to break it, and they should get credit. They sometimes don't.
Mm-hmm.
But the information, and they didn't have the ability after 1939, I understand.
Yeah, after they were invaded, yeah.
So it was Turing who, when they took the stuff to Bletchley Park, there were others who worked with him, but it was Turing who had all the ideas about how to build better machines and how to figure out how exactly. Now, was he an eccentric? Yes, they all seem to be. A lot of those mathematicians seem to be.
I mean, you kind of have to be at that point, because there's, I mean, this is when I was asked at one point if I was going to be a doctor or go for a doctorate degree. I was like, I'm not that, you know, excited to do that. But right. To get to that point where you're that skilled, like, you kind of have to be a bit eccentric. You have to be a little wild.
Very much eccentric. But he worked well with his colleagues, and they followed his lead, you know. So he's really the big name.
Mm-hmm.
I know there was the movie The Imitation Game. I haven't seen the movie, but I've read a lot about it. Unfortunately, a lot of people say, well, you know, a lot of people got left out for dramatic purposes. But really, you don't know a lot of names, per se. And I think it's just because the nature of the work. A lot of people, after the war, so just sort of went back to academia. The British never really, you know, unfortunately, the British never really recognized any of these guys who worked, because I think they were still trying to hide the secret.
Well, and they're not, it's not valorous. Like, it's not, they're not breaking into an enclosure somewhere. They're not risking their lives, per se,
right?
But in a way, they saved a bunch of lives. So,
right. And maybe some of the intelligence wasn't taken up, but there was stuff that was. And you're right, because they knew the movements and the positions of the Navy or armed forces. It did save someone. I mean, it did save lives.
Yeah, it's like, and this is going to be another video game reference. It's like in some games, you have I think this is actually used in military, the fog of war.
Yes.
Anything you can do to clear up that fog and know more about your opponent than
right. They
know about you is an advantage for you.
Right.
Because even if you can't necessarily do something in that instant, you might know something later on because you were able to act on what you know.
Right. And it just seemed like the Germans weren't really, I don't want to say they weren't good at it, but they kind of weren't. I mean, it was the Allies who were doing, you know, things like Operation Mincemeat. And then remember, before D-Day, they had that whole deception thing they did in the south of England with Patton, with this sort of made-up army he was supposed to lead, and, you know, inflatable tanks. I mean, mm-hmm. It just, the Germans never seemed to have that. And I was talking to Jason before we started recording, before you were here. The Germans never thought the code was broken. That's why they never did anything to change it. Admiral Dönitz, who was the head of the German Navy, the Kriegsmarine, as it's called, he always thought it was either radar or detection finding that caused this. Even in 1945, where the Allies were basically reading messages within a day or two of them getting them, he still thought, no, they can't have broken it. And after the war, there was a committee that sort of clandestinely detained a lot of these cryptological workers for the Germans, and the Germans said, well, you know, we knew the Enigma wasn't fail-safe. We knew it wasn't unbreakable. We just didn't think anybody would go to all the trouble to try breaking it.
Yeah. I mean, this is, like you mentioned,
when you think about it, you're kind of right.
Right. it's a relatively new thing. And if they're like, I mean, if we were going to try to do it, we wouldn't get there.
Right.
So I kind of, it's such an underrated thing, right?
Right. And I want to mention also about Alan Turing that he wasn't even recognized for his work until long, long after his death.
And he's British, right?
Yes.
Okay.
He died in 1950-something, 54, 52. He had some charges against him from the government. He was a homosexual, so that was illegal in Britain at the time.
Mm.
And no one knows for sure if he died of suicide or if it was accidental. But it wasn't until like 2009 until it was finally... I think people knew that he had done this, but he wasn't... The British government, I guess, had a formal apology for his arrest and then finally recognized what he did.
So for all that work that he did, just because he didn't fit into societal norms...
Right, and I think that may have hurt some of the cryptologists as well, because I don't want to use the word misfit, that's too pejorative,
mm-hmm.
but they were different than... like your frontline soldier or your general, or, you know, people who are actually in the military. And so, but they sure came up with a lot of good stuff for them. And a lot of the military people did respect the code breakers.
Yeah.
I don't want to suggest they didn't.
Yeah, but it's like soldiers on a field being, knowing and having a different respect for the people behind them communicating with them.
Right.
Like, it's different to have that than the public image that they have back home.
Right. And like, I think they just kept it secret because that's how it was, and they were going to keep it secret even after the war.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody's ever interested in reading about code breaking in general, there's this big behemoth of a book by David Kahn called The Code Breakers, which was originally published in 1967, but was revised in 1996. So the original version didn't include Bletchley Park because no one really knew about it. And it's, if you ever have a lot of time, it's a very long book, but it's like comprehensive. When he says comprehensive, he's not lying.
Yeah. And I'm looking at this book now, and that book is intimidating.
And it's not just World War II. It's the whole, he talks about, you know, ancient times using codes, and he actually has how they looked. It's kind of complicated.
Yeah. And like you mentioned with the breaking Japanese codes, the translation involved is a whole nother thing, because they had to have translators with them too.
Yes.
So it's code breaking plus translation, and then it's a lot of info, so you got to make sure.
Right.
You know,
so in some ways, yes, there was an intelligence failure at Pearl Harbor, but in other ways, they knew something was going to happen because they had the message that they had translated that said, break off diplomatic relations at 1 p.m. local time in Washington, D.C. on December 7th.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, D.C. is like 5 or 6 hours ahead of Hawaii, and that's when the Pearl Harbor. They're all kind of coordinated to happen at the same time.
So you mentioned through the Cold War that code breaking was still relevant for Cold War. Now in our like hyper digital age, do you think like code breaking as a whole still is an important factor for governments at least, or governments, military?
Yeah, in the Cold War it was probably more, you know, technologically advanced,
mm-hmm.
and it probably would be today. Because I think people would still send stuff in a coded language, but it would probably be, it's probably so secret we wouldn't really know what what anybody is using. I'm sure it's not radios anymore per se.
Yeah.
They just intercept wireless traffic or computers. I mean,
and computers are a lot better now. Like they,
right.
I could imagine that computers now would be able to crack the Enigma code very quickly,
pretty fast. Yeah. You just need to feed it a few things. Or AI, like you said, maybe AI is being used to create codes. Or even, you know, people, you think it's a person and it's AI writing everything or talking.
Yeah. So. It's a very interesting topic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you picked it because this is something I didn't really think about that often.
Right.
Like, I've known of Alan Turing because I've done some AI things, and a lot of his work actually was very foundational
to
AI. Right. And so that he worked in code breaking World War II is just fascinating. And so I'm curious what you've picked to talk about next time.
Well, it won't be code breaking.
Okay.
So I thought, you know, I haven't been to Asia for a while.
Oh.
So I thought I'd talk about the Silk Road.
Okay.
And was it a road actually made out of silk? Probably not.
No, probably not, but we'll find out next time. Oh, hey, Scott, did you know that listeners can actually contact us now?
They can. How can they do that?
Yeah, they can just email us at historycruise@mykpl.info.
Great. Also, like and subscribe on any of the platforms you find this podcast.